Okay, so this is the last lecture of BSM today. I'll try and cover the composite Higgs models that I talked about a bit in the previous lectures. And maybe if I have time at the end, I'll mention a bit the axion, but not in the context of the usual strong CP solution, but how it's been used to understand why the Higgs mass is light in a cosmological type of solution. Just to give a sense of the different types of approaches that people are now considering for solving naturalness problems. So to summarize the lectures so far, we started with a picture of the standard model as an effective field theory and its shortcomings. And this was really to emphasize the way in which symmetry controls the structure of the standard model and why the naturalness problems are real problems that are generic in the sense that they control the structure of radiative corrections and quantum corrections that lead you to expect why certain parameters are small or not. The types of approaches to solving these naturalness problems for the Higgs were typically supersymmetry, composite Higgs, which are also related to theories which I won't have time to go into here, that are extra dimensional, large extra dimensions that postulate essentially extra spatial dimensions so that you could lower the Planck scale where it is effectively at the TeV scale. There are also many approaches actually, but I won't have time to go into all of them, but there are, well, anthropic landscape type solutions, cosmological type solutions. So in particular, you could appeal to cosmological dynamics for understanding why the Higgs could be a dynamical quantity that is determined in the early universe, or perhaps you have many sectors with different Higgs mass and then inflation only reheats the light one preferentially. And this is one way in which you could maybe explain why our universe is populated with a small Higgs VeV. Okay, I'll put this in brackets because we won't really have time to talk about this. But to start with the picture of composite Higgs, we first have to understand the framework of nonlinear electroweak chiral Lagrangians. This is a different type of effective field theory to the one that we've been discussing so far, where you just add the higher dimensional operator terms. This is a type of theory that is separating the heavy degrees of freedom that form part of a multiplet with the light degrees of freedom. And so you can't just decouple them in the usual naive way. And this is the way in which pions were first described as the low energy theory below the QCD scale . So let me call this L pi, as a low energy below the QCD scale of the effective Goldstone degrees of freedom. And there is a sense in which below the electroweak scale as well, before you knew what was responsible for electroweak symmetry breaking, you could also write down such a nonlinear chiral Lagrangian for the electroweak theory. So let me write nonlinear electroweak theory. The idea will be to then apply this to the Higgs and say that it comes from some new sector that also breaks some new strong dynamics, some new symmetry at this heavy scale F, let's say around the TeV or so, and the Higgs is just like the pion, a Goldstone boson from this new sector. So we can write down a nonlinear chiral Lagrangian for that theory in analogy with a chiral Lagrangian for the pions. Okay. So this goes under the name of nonlinear Carre-Lagrangian or nonlinear sigma model. Or sometimes called sigma model. So let me start with the toy example of a theory involving fermions and scalars, where we just have, let's forget about gauging, a fermion that couples to some scalar in a way that respects the SU2 left and SU2 right global symmetry of the scalar. Okay, so we have some 2x2 sigma matrix parameterizing the scalars. So this is a 2x2 matrix of scalars. And we can always write a 2x2 unitary matrix in terms of a Pauli basis. So we decompose this in terms of a field sigma times a 2x2 identity matrix, plus a triplet of fields where this sigma is the Pauli sigma matrix. Okay, so this is the field sigma. These are three fields, pi, and this is the sigma Pauli matrix. Okay, so any 2x2 unitary matrix can be decomposed in this Pauli basis. And to this, we just have to first write down the kinetic terms for these fields. And the mass terms and the potential terms. The second, yes, this should all be part of the Ciccawa coupling G. Okay. And in case it wasn't clear, I'm a bit of a rebel, so I use the plus, minus, minus metric just to annoy Cliff. No clapping? No? Okay. Well, you can put that in your feedback.
The intro thing, you got to be happy.
in the quartic, the potential term, that's not the sigma vector in square, right? That's just the sigma.
In the quartic?
Yes.
It's a sigma squared plus pi squared.
So it's not the sigma, it's not the vector sigma, it's the field sigma.
Oh, yes, sorry. Okay, so sigma is a singlet and pi is a triplet under this SU2 cross SU2 left . So this is a global symmetry where sigma transforms like the left and the right on both sides, okay, where these are the SU2 unitary transformations. Okay, you can think of the psi as the 2x2 isospin doublets of the proton and neutron or the up and down quarks. This was the original context in which the theory of pions was written down. And you can see that this is like an SO4 transformation on the potential, where if you write down the phis in terms of the three pis and the phi and the sigma as a four plot of SO4, then this is your usual potential where the SO4 symmetry is manifest. Okay, now when this phi gets a VEV, okay, we have the freedom to rotate and put the VEV along any direction we want in this space, and we can impose this restriction, okay, where this VEV phi in terms of the parameters of the Lagrangian is mu squared over lambda, the minus sign since it gets a VEV. So we can choose to have sigma get the vacuum expectation value F and pi to be the Goldstone degrees of freedom. And shift sigma goes to sigma minus F. Okay, so the resulting Lagrangian is then the usual one that after electroweak symmetry breaking, or in this case after symmetry breaking of the scalar phi, gives a mass to the fermions. So we have GF as the mass of the psis. We have the kinetic terms, which I won't write down again.
Would it be a minus sign for the mass term?
Yes, so you put a minus sign, well, however you define it, then you just make sure it gets a vacuum expectation value.
Oh, yeah, right, because F is negative, so.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So we see that the sigma gets a VEV. The sigma gets a mass. And the point of this now is that if we want to write down the low energy theory, where the mass of the sigma is the heavy scale in your low energy theory, your cutoff, so you want to decouple the sigma then we have a problem if we try to remove this from the theory in the same way that we did for the Fermi theory with the W boson. We took that contact diagram, and at high energies, that was the W boson, and we could just remove that at low energies and be left with a contact diagram of Fermi theory at low energies. And we did that with the standard model effective field theory too, with the leptonic quark at high energies. We could just remove it and then have the contact interaction at low energies. But let's see what happens if we do this here. Okay. If we have the pion interacting with the heavy sigma in this diagram, then you see that this coupling, okay, is proportional to lambda F. Okay, this is a trilinear coupling. And the mass of the sigma is proportional to square root of lambda F. And what we want to do is to, we called it integrating out the heavy particle to to be left with a low energy theory. Okay, but what happens as we take the mass heavy? Okay, as the mass becomes heavier relative to the low energy scale, so does the coupling. Okay, so we can't take this, let's say, as f goes to infinity, where infinity is just a heavy scale relative to the low energy theory. The coupling lambda f also goes to infinity. Okay. So the way in which we decouple this heavy sigma field violates the original symmetry of our theory that rotates the pi's and the sigmas together in one multiplet. So the reason why we can't just decouple it in this naive way is because that breaks the symmetry explicitly. So we want to do it in a way that keeps the symmetry of the theory. So how to decouple heavy sigma? In a symmetry respecting way. Okay, there's different ways of doing this. The naive sort of way of doing this in the simplest way that respects the symmetry is to use the invariant relation phi squared equals f squared. So sigma squared is related to the other pi's in this SO4 invariant way through the VEV. Okay, and so we can just substitute this into the Lagrangian to decouple it. And this is then the low energy nonlinear sigma model for pions. It gives you this funny Lagrangian if you substitute that in. Okay, you get this pi dot d mu pi squared over f squared minus pi squared. Plus the kinetic term for the fermions, which I won't write down. And then the coupling of the fermions to the pi's. Okay, so this looks a little bit funny. And the reason why it looks funny is because we had to decouple the sigma in this way that respects the symmetry of the original UV Lagrangian, but is not manifest in the low-energy Lagrangian. Okay, so you could say that the three remaining degrees of freedom, the Goldstone degrees of freedom, transform in this strange way in this Lagrangian in such a way that it respects the original symmetry despite the sigma being missing. So this is why when people say that the term symmetry breaking, electroweak symmetry breaking, is a bit of a misnomer, is that the symmetry isn't really broken. It still has to be respected, and this is precisely in the way in which it's still respected when you remove one of the fields in the multiplet.
Sorry.
Yep.
When you say the symmetry of the UV Lagrangian, didn't we already break any symmetry between sigmas and pi's by the VEV?
This is why the word breaking is not really accurate in the sense that, yes, when it gets a VEV, it breaks the symmetry, but the symmetry of the Lagrangian is still there. Okay, the VEV is just the background in which, yes, you're breaking the symmetry, but the interactions of the Lagrangian and everything is still the original symmetry invariant Lagrangian. Okay. So you could say this is the low energy remnant of this UV symmetry. But the reason this looks funny is just the choice of field coordinates or the field parameterization we're using. And we're free to choose any field parameterization we want. And a more convenient parameterization, which allows us to decouple this in a friendlier way, is to exponentiate the 3 degrees of freedom that are the Goldstones and put them in this matrix U. Okay, so rho is now your singlet field, and U parameterizes, now I'll call them, I think it's psi, this funny squiggle thing?
Yes.
Yep, okay. Apologies to any Greeks for that psi. And this U matrix, okay, is parameterizing now the Goldstone degrees of freedom, where this is, again, the sigma Pauli matrices, and these are now your pion degrees of freedom. And this is now your radial degree of freedom in these coordinates. Okay, so rho is now a singlet under the original symmetry, under the full SU2 left cross SU2 right symmetry. And psi is now a triplet. Now, the reason why that's important is that because this is now a singlet under the full SU2 left cross SU2 right, and this is now a triplet under the full SU2 left cross SU2 right, when we do a transformation, they transform amongst themselves, and the singlet doesn't mix with them. So now we can decouple the rho if the vacuum expectation value is, we shift it by the vacuum expectation value, and we can decouple this in an SU2 left cross SU2 right invariant way. Okay, we can see that rho squared can be written now as trace of sigma dagger sigma, which in the original coordinates were just sigma squared plus pi squared, and this is what gets the VEV. So now we just shift rho by the VEV. And it becomes a lot easier to write down the low energy theory. Okay, and then the interactions between the fermions and these low-energy degrees of freedom comes all parameterized through this U matrix. Okay, plus the, again, as an EFT, write down all the possible allowed terms. Okay, so this theory is a lot simpler in many ways. Okay, we had originally rho squared, trace of d mu u dagger d mu u, and then integrating out or making decoupling the heavy radial rho degree of freedom was just a question of replacing it with f. Now, it's called a nonlinear chiral Lagrangian because in this basis, okay, the psi transforms nonlinearly now under the original SU2 left cross SU2 right. Okay, you can see this by seeing how the psi's transform, since they're exponentiated in this parameterization. And if you do an SU2 left cross SU2 right transformation, then you see that by relating the exponential transformations to the psi field in the exponent of u, you have a nonlinear relation between the psi. Okay, so you get some new psi that is some nonlinear function of the original psi. Yep.
What are the components of psi?
The components of psi?
Yeah.
The three components? So there's three components. And what do you mean by the components exactly?
Well,
it's a scalar field, and there's three of them that form a triplet.
How do those components relate to the sigma and pi fields?
To the sigma and pi fields. Oh, well. Okay, so in this way, this is a 2x2 matrix. Okay, in this exponent. So you have the sigma, sigma Pauli matrices that are 2x2, and this is a 2x2 matrix. And then the rho is a singlet field. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, are the L and R there the same as the UL UR here?
Yes, sorry. That should be UL UR transformation. Yep. Yeah, the notation's a bit confusing. I use the U for the matrix and the U for the, yeah. Okay. So maybe just write L and R here instead.
The R should be transposed then.
Yes, on that one, yes, yeah. Okay, good. Okay, so this is the pion theory of SU2 left cross SU2 right spontaneously broken down to SU2V. Okay, you can see this from the fact that when the sigma gets a VEV, the left and right can no longer transform independently. So the left and right have to transform vectorially, in that they have to transform the same. And the reason why this describes the pions even before anyone knew anything about QCD is that it's the global symmetry that matters to the low energy theory. Whatever breaks the global symmetry, in this case, we started with the explicit UV theory where we put in a scalar field phi, and the scalar field phi gets a VEV, and then the low energy theory are the Goldstone degrees of freedom of that breaking. In QCD, we know that it's the confinement of the quarks, okay, that break. That break this global symmetry. Okay. And we still don't know really what the operator is that gets a VEV, I think. So this could be some q bar left, q bar right that gets a vacuum expectation value, or it could be something else. But all that the low energy theory of pions needs to know is that some SU2 left cross SU2 right is broken, and the theory will look like that at low energies. Okay, so in Nambu's time, when he wrote down the Carrel Lagrangian for pions, he didn't know about QCD, but he could still write down that theory because the SU2 left cross SU2 right symmetry was that of protons and neutrons. And the protons and neutrons were the two isospin symmetries that related them. Okay, you could also do this for SU3. Where we know in the standard model that this is still a good approximation because the up, down, and strange are still closely related enough in mass that the symmetry is still a useful approximate symmetry. Now, what I didn't write down was the terms that explicitly break this symmetry in the UV. Okay, so you also have explicit breaking. From quark masses, which is why this global symmetry is not exact. And this will give a potential to the pions and give them an explicit break mass. Otherwise, they would be massless. If the quarks were massless and there was nothing in the UV theory that explicitly broke this, then the pions would be exact Goldstone bosons, and they would have an exact shift symmetry. But as we learned from this technical naturalness argument, that anything that explicitly breaks the symmetry, the effects that break it must go proportional to it. So if we had explicit breaking through the quark masses in the original UV theory, then the Goldstones would no longer obey an exact shift symmetry, and the extent to which they don't obey that exact shift symmetry must be proportional to the quark masses. Okay. So that was a very quick introduction to the nonlinear Carolingian. How many of you have studied that before? Yeah. Okay. So I think this is something which is quite important to understand the different types of ways in which we can write down low energies. And indeed, this is how we understand pions and kaons and describe nature below the electroweak, below the QCD scale. And if you write down another low energy theory for the axion, for example, then the QCD axion described below the QCD scale interacting with the pions is precisely the nonlinear Carolingian of pions together with an axion degree of freedom. And the two mix in a way that is responsible for giving the masses to the QCD axion. This framework is also used to describe the composite Higgs models that I mentioned. And the idea is not as grand as supersymmetry in the sense that it's not going to solve the hierarchy problem to all scales. Yep.
About the pions, if I remember correctly, the pions contribute to the neutron, EGM. How does it come from this?
Yeah, this is a calculation which I was thinking of doing for the QCD axion when we talk about the strong CP problem. Okay, we can look at how this can contribute to the neutron EDM, but unfortunately, I don't think we'll have time for that. Sorry, but I can point you to the reference if you'd like after that goes through this. Okay, but I do think it's important to understand the general idea of a nonlinear Carolingian, just because when I write down this picture now, okay. At least it'll make sense when I talk about the Higgs as a Goldstone boson in analogy with the pions. Okay, so the idea is we have, yep.
Yeah, is that the blank mass or what's the?
Yes, I'm just drawing the scales of the picture that we're envisioning here is that we have the gut scale, the Planck scale, okay. Now you can imagine that neutrinos are generated by right-handed neutrinos close to the gut scale, okay, in the seesaw mechanism. We have the standard model here at V, it's about 246 GeV, the weak scale. And the different ways in which we make the Higgs not being sensitive to these very high scales and to understand the hierarchy between them. Although I have to be careful with the word hierarchy problem. Sometimes people mean it in a sense that why is there this large separation of scales between everything that indicates that grand unified theories, the neutrino mass scale, the Planck scale is so high, and then we have such a wide gap between there and the weak scale. That's an aesthetic problem in a sense that why should we have these very vast disparate scales? And then there's the hierarchy problem in a naturalness sense of why is the Higgs not as heavy as that when the kind of arguments of naturalness and fine tuning that we mentioned would lead us to expect it to be there. Okay. Supersymmetry is one way in which you render it insensitive to that scale. Okay. compositeness says that around the TEV scale, you now have a new strong sector. Okay, let's say there's an analogy with QCD. Let's say we have a new SUN that confines. Okay, it doesn't have to be SUN, and it could be also any other ways in which you can break a global symmetry. But let's say we have a new SUN that confines, becomes strongly coupled. And then from this, you get a pion-like degree of freedom. And this pion-like degree of freedom is gauged under SU2 and gets a potential and gets a vacuum expectation value and breaks that dynamically. So this is the Higgs as a Sudermann-Goldstone boson. One minimal realization of this idea is that we have, here, let me just write down what I said explicitly. Okay, so at this scale, we have a global symmetry that is broken. Okay, where H here is not the Higgs, it's some symmetry group. So we could say, for example, in the minimal model, for example, that would give you this is an SO5 breaking to an SO4 global symmetry. And the reason why this is minimal in some sense is that you need at least 4 Goldstone degrees of freedom. So in this case, the number of Goldstones is 4. And we don't have to specify what it is, again, that breaks this. We just have to assume that there's some global symmetry breaking pattern. And the Higgs emerges as a pseudo-Nambu-Goldstone boson from this sector. So these 4 degrees of freedom, we can again arrange in a phi 4-plet, where we have, again, the 3 degrees of freedom. In this case, we also charge the Higgs under SU2 so that it also couples to the electric gauge bosons, such that when this gets a potential, it will also break the electric symmetry. Okay, so first we have to write down the low energy theory of the Goldstone degrees of freedom. Now we have 4 of them instead of the 3 pions. Okay, and remember that one way to write down this low energy theory is to write the original scalar field. Let's call this big phi. Okay, this is the 5-plet. And we write the 5th degree of freedom as the one that gets a vacuum expectation value. Sorry, let's call this the sigma in analogy with previously, okay? So we can parameterize the breaking by also giving a VEV to this. Okay, you imagine that this 5-plet gets a VEV at the scale F, and then we again decouple the sigma in this SO5 invariant way. And this then gives you the low energy degree, low energy EFT for the Higgs. We could also have done this in the other parameterization, but let me just do it in this way. Okay, so if we write down, well, I won't write down the full Lagrangian. That might take time to go into how the potential is generated and so on. But let's just look at the kinetic term for this phi plet. Okay, so this is the big phi. Where this is the covariant derivative. Yes, and we want to also put the hypercharge gauge field there. Okay. Sorry?
No QCD here.
No.
Oh, okay.
This is, you don't want the Higgs to break QCD.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yep. So if we write this term out in terms of the Higgs degree of freedom, let me just rewrite the four Nambu-Goldstone degrees of freedom in terms of an SU2 doublet, okay. We can always write the Higgs in terms of the 4 degrees of freedom in this way. You have phi 2 plus I phi 1 and phi 4 minus I phi 3. So that when we have a VEV, for the Higgs doublet in unitary gauge, this would then be V plus H. After electroweak symmetry breaking, okay, the Higgs gets a vacuum expectation value. So we're now imagining that below the scale F at the scale V, the Higgs has a potential such that it gets a vacuum expectation value. And in terms of the original five-plet of scalars, this would then be V plus H for the fourth component of the four scalars. And remember that we decouple the radial sigma degree of freedom by substituting the SO5 invariant relation, where we have F squared minus phi squared, which is just V plus H squared. Okay. So we substitute this, and write out the terms, where we have a kinetic term for the Higgs, and then we have the kinetic term for that fifth component that we've integrated out. Okay, then you can do some steps to expand that and get to leading order what looks like a modification of the Higgs kinetic term. Okay, so the steps to get to here was to write down the low energy theory of the Nambu-Goldstone boson by integrating out the radial degree of freedom by substituting this SO5 invariant relation. And then this Nambu-Goldstone degree of freedom has a potential, which we didn't derive, but let's say it gets a potential that then breaks electroweak symmetry at the scale V. And so we substituted the vacuum expectation value for the Higgs, we shifted it by the vacuum expectation value. And in unitary gauge, these would then be zero in the usual way. And so the low energy theory for the Nabu-Goldstone degrees of freedom then looks like a Higgs with a modified kinetic term. So when I said before that a generic consequence of composite Higgs models was that they would have a suppressed couplings to the gauge bosons, the reason is that if you do a field redefinition to canonically normalize the kinetic term, this shows up as a suppression in the couplings to the gauge bosons. And so what happens is in the covariant derivative of the fiveplet, we then get that the couplings of the gauge bosons that come from the covariant derivative Okay, I think there's. Okay, there's a factor here which I'm not sure about, but let me just gloss over that. Okay, so this shift in the kinetic term then shows up as a suppression of the couplings of the Higgs to the gauge bosons, which in the limit in which F is much larger than V, as we decouple the compositeness scale, this is just the standard model coupling to the W and Z.
What's the factor in front of Z squared? Is it 1/2?
1/2 and something here, I'm not sure. I think it might be GW squared, but I can't even read my own handwriting. So it's, let me see, if we have G squared over, yeah, I think it's basically a factor of the Weinberg angle is the difference between the coupling of the Z and W. But, yeah. So the generic consequence is a suppression of the couplings of HVV couplings, which is proportional to 1 minus v squared over f squared. Now, this immediately relates the fine-tuning of the Higgs boson and the electric scale related to the compositeness scale f and the couplings to the electric gauge bosons. So the more standard model-like it is, the more you have to decouple the compositeness sector, and the more fine-tuned getting a light Higgs is. Yep?
In the Lagrangian D phi dimension phi on top, the capital phi's have components, so are they contracted together?
Yes, so you should put in the full five-plet. Okay, the masses for the fermions in this framework come from composite operators that would also come from the strong sector. Okay, if we have confinement of some strong sector at the scale F, then we don't just expect the Higgs as a Nabu-Goldstone boson. That would be the lightest degrees of freedom, given that it has a shift symmetry. But we'd also expect all kinds of other degrees of freedom that, as we know with QCD as well, comes with all kinds of resonances. so the way in which the fermion masses are generated in this picture is that we have the Yukawa terms coming by a linear mixing between the standard model fermions. Okay, let's say this is the standard model fermions and some new composite operator. So this is a composite field from the strong sector, from the new strong sector, not the QCD strong sector. Okay, and then you'd have also the mass term for this new resonance.
Mass squared.
Yes.
And then minus.
No, this is a, sorry, this is a fermion degree, fermionic degree of freedom,
okay?
Because we have a mixing between two fermions, so this would be a, this would be a dimensionful coupling in this case. Okay.
But I mean, why isn't there still a minus sign? So I agree for the mass being not m squared, but just m, so that I agree. But isn't there like a minus sign or my?
I mean, we'll have to diagonalize the matrix anyway after. Okay. And then the sign depends on what the eigenstate degrees of freedom are.
Yeah.
Yep.
So what does that say before a strong sector?
A new strong sector. Sorry. So, you know, when we say strong, that could imply QCD. Which is why we also use feebly interacting particles rather than weakly interacting particles, because weak also means SU2 weak. Okay, so then if we have a composite sector term, okay, that goes like chi bar h chi, then this, after diagonalizing, would then give some rotation angle from diagonalizing the mass eigenstates. Because we have some mixing between the composite and the standard model degrees of freedom, and the eigenstates will then be a mixture of the two. And it's precisely when we go to the mass eigenstates that we get a light one that has an effective Yukawa of this form. Okay, so this is the Yukawa that we call the standard model one. Now, there is a bit more model dependence in this picture. Okay, this was just a rough idea of where the fermion masses in this composite picture comes from. But what these chi's are and how they mix with the standard model degrees of freedom depends on the representations that you choose for these chi's. And then the representations that you choose for these chi's then determines what that Yukawa actually looks like. Okay, maybe we'll just want to, yep?
Does this reduce the amount of parameters you need to find all the standard model Yukawas?
No, actually. If anything, it increases it. So it depends on the type of flavor model building you can do. Okay, so this is not trying to explain the origin of the Yukawas in terms of justifying the flavor structure. It's saying that in composite Higgs models, the Yukawas are related to the composite sector in this way, and then you could do some flavor model building to reduce the number of parameters. or at least to understand better the structure. Okay, but you do get a similar story where, depending on the representation, okay, of these chi's, you do also get a suppression of the couplings of the Higgs to top or to the other particles, which you might expect to see as well. Now, even before the LHC switched on, there were already constraints on this. Okay. Yep.
So just to be sure I understand like the picture. So in the strong QCD sector, as we go to higher energies like super UV sector, quarks are deconfined and we have quark plasma, right? For example. But in these models, at high energies, it's the other way around. Like at high energies, we have confinement in the heat?
No, think of it as going down the other way, okay? Just like when you go down above the QCD scale, we have deconfinement, and then we go down to lower energies, we have confinement of QCD, and then below that we have the pions, okay? It's the same thing here. We go above this scale, we have, let's say, some new SUN sector. We go down from the gut scale down to the TEV scale, and this now confines. And then below that we have the pion-like degrees of freedom, which in this case is the Higgs, okay? So the picture is the same. And if you reverse it, yes, when you go back to higher energy scales, it deconfines, and then you have, if we could go to probe these scales, then we'd see the underlying theory, just like QCD. Okay? And the only difference in this picture is that the pion of this sector has a potential that gets a non-zero vacuum expectation value. So the constraints on this coming from precision measurements at lower energies, even below the electroweak symmetry breaking scale, before we discovered the Higgs, we were already sensitive to modifications of the Higgs couplings to gauge bosons from LEP, okay, which precisely measured, these are electroweak precision tests, okay, at LEP. And just to give you a sense of how these constraints come about, okay, one of the things that LEP measures very precisely is the rho parameter. Okay, this has nothing to do with the rho field before. This is just a parameter that people call the rho parameter that parameterizes the difference between the W and the Z boson mass. Okay, this is expected to be approximately 1 in the standard model. And the reason for that is the Higgs sector respects an SO4 global symmetry. So again, these things are controlled by the symmetries of your theory. And there is nothing that breaks the O4 symmetry of the Higgs sector except for the hypercharge coupling, which distinguishes between the Z boson comes from a mix of the hypercharge and the third component of the 3 degrees of freedom that would otherwise be completely symmetric between each other. So if there were no hypercharge, then MW over MZ would be exactly 1. And the only thing in the standard model that breaks this symmetry is the coupling to hypercharge, hence this relation.
What's LDP?
LEP.
Yeah, I know, but what does it stand for?
The large, what does it stand for? Yeah, large electron positron collider, LEP collider, yeah. So, this was a collider back in the 80s, okay, 80s and 90s, that really established the gauge structure of the standard model. Okay, before that, UA1 and UA2 discovered the W and the Z, but you know it was a big mess of events that was far from a precision machine, and LEP really measured the properties of the gauge structure at the Z pole and the WW and things like that very precisely. Okay. So LEP is actually a perfect example of a highly successful collider that told us a huge amount about the gauge structure of the standard model and really established the picture, the modern picture of the standard model. And it didn't discover a single new particle. Okay. So discovering new particles is not always what it's all about. It's a bit like JWST and LIGO and so on. You know, you're really just trying to measure things and observe things as precisely as possible to make sure everything is consistent. And maybe as a side effect of that, one day you get some deviation. But yeah, I'd really recommend looking, I don't know, at Chris Quigg's book, for example. He has a nice textbook, Quigg textbook, for example, or some other references, which if you look at the picture of particle physics before LEP and after LEP, you know, what we knew about the couplings of Z bosons, you know, the parameters GV and GA, the axial and vector couplings, you know, they go from like a huge parameter space down to shrinking down to a really small parameter space, you know. And the constraints on the rho parameter, which I'm about to talk about, okay, are constraints on, you can see this as a higher dimensional operator as well. Okay, you can write down a dimension 6 operator, h dagger d mu h squared. This is a dimension 6 operator, which is equivalent to the rho parameter. And this is sometimes called the t parameter as well. So the rho parameter is sometimes called the t parameter. There's another dimension 6 parameter called the s parameter. So we also have the S parameter. And these were two very strong constraints at LEP that constrained the possibilities, not just for composite Higgs models, but even for the standard model Higgs and the top, which hadn't been discovered yet at the time. So by precisely measuring these two parameters, S and T, which are constrained by the couplings of the Z and W, it placed constraints that things had to lie within a certain ellipse. The standard model was predicted to be there, but had the Higgs been too large, it would have gone out of this ellipse. Had the top been too heavy, it would also have gone out of this ellipse somewhere. Okay, so the fact that it had to lie within here already gave constraints that the Higgs in the standard model couldn't be higher than 140 GeV or something like that. And the top couldn't be too heavy either. And the composite scale couldn't be too low. Okay, so this T parameter is related to this rho that I defined here by just rho minus 1. And as I said, it's basically a parameterization of the self-energy of the W3 boson minus the W1 and 2, okay, which looks a bit like. Okay, so you get these kind of loop diagrams that contribute to the self-energy, and the difference in the W3 and W1, 2, okay, is what we call the T parameter. So if you modify the Higgs couplings to this, then you get a suppression in this. And so the T parameter, when you calculate this, will now have a suppression relative to the standard model expectation. And this then places limits on your V over F. Okay. I think. Okay, I'll just write it down since it's pretty straightforward. So in the standard model, this is something like g prime squared over 16 pi squared from the loop factor and the log lambda over mh minus the other diagram in the standard model where you have the W3 in the loop. So this is a g prime squared over 16 pi squared log lambda over mz. Okay. And this then told you that the Higgs mass couldn't be too heavy because otherwise this log would be too large. OK, Okay, so this is in the standard model. Okay, so measuring these parameters very precisely gives you sensitivity to loop corrections that, even with a logarithmic dependence on the Higgs mass, could place an upper bound on the Higgs mass. Now, redoing this in the composite Higgs model in the CHM and taking into account the suppression in the couplings gives the same thing, but now with log, you can rewrite it as an effective Higgs mass, where this effective Higgs mass is now modified compared to the original one by a factor that depends on your V over F. Okay, so it's just because you get this modification of the couplings, okay, which you then take into the log to rewrite it in terms of the same expression you got originally, but you just redefine an effective Higgs, where you see that the larger this is, if you make F too small, then you would be excluded. So the indirect constraints from LEP were already telling you that the compositeness scale had to be around a TeV. Of course, these are indirect constraints. You could also have other things that modify and enter in this calculation, other degrees of freedom that then take you back inside this ellipse. And so you could still have a low compositeness scale and other contributions that don't evade these bounds. Okay, so indirect bounds are always, in some sense, model dependent. But as I said, for supersymmetry, that even before the LHC switched on, there were indications that maybe this picture wasn't right and we wouldn't find anything at the LHC. For composite Higgs models as well, the LEP constraints on V over F were already telling us that even in these models, the Higgs is somewhat fine-tuned at the 10% level. Yep?
Capital lambda is lambda QCD?
No, sorry. Capital lambda, in this case, is the cutoff of your theory. So it's... It's, you could say it's F, the cutoffs of your calculation. Okay. So this is just parameterizing the divergence in the loop. Okay. We could do a similar calculation of this higher dimensional operator contribution. Okay, by you could see naively how it contributes to the difference in the W3 and W12 by taking the covariant derivative, the W bosons in the covariant derivative, putting the Higgs to its vacuum expectation value, and then you get the contribution of that operator to the true parameter. Okay, but we won't do that here. Okay, so in the last 20 minutes, maybe I want to talk a bit about the axion in terms of the strong CP problem, okay, and the Higgs mass problem. I won't focus on the QCD axion so much, since you already heard about that, and you'll probably hear about that again in the last lecture. Is there any questions about composite Higgs before I move on? Okay, maybe the other motivation for going through composite Higgs was not just to introduce you to the nonlinear chiral Lagrangian, which I think is an important thing to know about in its own, but also to contrast this with the supersymmetric theory of yesterday. Okay, this is a theory that works. It's a theory that is also a solution to the naturalist problem of the Higgs, but a lot of people didn't find it especially compelling. Okay, and there are also things that I glossed over, like where does the potential of this Higgs come from? You know, if it's a Pseudo-Nambu-Goldstone boson, then why does it get a potential that breaks the electric symmetry? Okay, you have to then you then have to couple it in such a way that a potential is generated and it breaks electric symmetry. And this is done in a way that is in some sense ad hoc. So it was a nice alternative that looks somewhat plausible. Okay, you could have a new strong sector. That Goldstone could get a vacuum expectation value and so on. But it doesn't have that same sense of inevitability and that same sense of things popping out in a non-trivial way. In this case, it's something that's plausible, that could happen, but you sort of had to put in everything by hand to be just so. And actually, the theory, even before composite Higgs, was the Technicolor of the 80s, which was in direct analogy with QCD confining. And QCD confining also breaks electroweak symmetry and doesn't have a Higgs in it. But QCD confining gives only a tiny mass to the W's and Z's. Then they would have been something like 90 MeV or something like that instead of GeV. But you could imagine that you had a new strong sector at the 90 GeV scale or so that confines and then gives masses directly to the W and Z without a Higgs degree of freedom. But that was already immediately excluded back then. And the composite Higgs mechanism was a way of decoupling the composite sector, the confinement scale, and then having the Goldstone as the thing that breaks electric symmetry rather than the confinement directly. Okay. So one thing that I wanted to mention about the strong CP problem, okay, is now we have, again, this picture where we have the Planck scale. We imagine that there may be a grand unified scale around 10 to the 15 GeV. Okay. And you heard from your lectures with Nick that an axion, a QCD axion, could solve the strong CP problem if you had some new. Again, we use the scale F as the scale of some new sector that breaks the global symmetry. And in this case, the global symmetry that is broken is the U1 Pecri-Quinn symmetry. So be careful, these are global symmetries, okay? When we talk about SU2 left, SU2 right of the pions and SO5 to SO4 of the composite Higgs and so on, we're imagining it's a global symmetry in some sector. So again, we don't have to specify what is the sector that breaks this global symmetry. We just imagine that whatever this UV Lagrangian was, it had this U1 Pecri-Quinn symmetry that is spontaneously broken. And a consequence of that is the axion as a low energy degree of freedom, as the Goldstone boson degree of freedom. Okay. Now this axion has to be very, very light. The thing that if we forget about QCD, had QCD not existed and not confined, then this axion from the U1 Pecri-Quinn breaking would have been massless or has to have an extremely tiny mass. And the reason for that is that the QCD axion must get its potential from QCD breaking. Okay, so it's in this way that it solves the strong CP problem by having its potential generated from QCD confinement, which then leads it to have a vacuum expectation value at a low scale. Okay. So if we call the axion phi here, then this F is, okay, let me write lambda QCD rather than F. Okay. Okay, the confinement of QCD generates this term in the potential that then allows the QCD axion to solve the strong CP problem at the minimum of this potential. Okay, I won't go through this again, since you already heard about it, and you'll hear more about the U1 PQ breaking and everything in the QCD axion lecture. I just want to give you a sense of how the QCD axion is also used to, or axions in general, are also used to understand why the Higgs mass is light. Okay. So this is a theory that was introduced maybe 8 years ago or so, called the relaxion. And the reason why it's called a relaxion is that it relaxes the Higgs mass to its value that we observe today. Yep.
Is there a special reason the potential has to be periodic with its function of cosine?
Has to be periodic. Yes, there's very good reasons. And I wish I had time to talk about that, but it's related to the topological structure of QCD and the strong CP problem that we talked about. The reason why it's a theta angle, okay, is related. It's not just a free parameter that can be anything. Okay, it's I won't have time to go into all that. I don't know if Nick actually went through the strong CP problem in detail in deriving why theta is a theta angle and why it's the total derivative term is not. Okay, so basically the rough story is just that this strong CP term in the Lagrangian, okay, can be written as a total derivative, which doesn't vanish because the boundary conditions of a vanishing gauge field is not zero, in that you have pure gauges that are gauge equivalent to zero, and you have to take into account the non-trivial topological structure of all the allowed vacuums of QCD. Okay, so the QCD axion, this is also related to the chiral symmetry of the Lagrangian. When you do a chiral transformation of the Lagrangian, the action, okay, is not necessarily in the measure of even though this might be invariant under the chiral symmetry, when you have the measure of the path integral, the measure also transforms under that, and you can show that it's equivalent to this term in the Lagrangian. Okay, so in a sense, the axion is the Goldstone boson of this chiral symmetry, and this is how it enters in this term. Okay, you could just write down phi GG dual, okay, but it's related to the theta parameter in this way. Okay, so it's, I'll have to do a whole lecture just to go through that in proper detail, okay? But let me now talk about how the Higgs potential, okay, in these kind of theories in which, okay, maybe we don't have supersymmetry, maybe we don't have composite Higgs at the weak scale or solving the naturalness problem, maybe they are heavy, and maybe the Higgs is indeed heavy at some scale that we'll call big M. Okay, let's say that maybe big M is 100 TeV or so, okay, or could be heavier, but we're not trying to solve the hierarchy problem up to arbitrary high scales. We're just saying that maybe supersymmetry or some other naturalizing mechanism is at higher scales. But the reason why the Higgs is not tuned, okay, is that we have a coupling of the Higgs 2 some axion-like field. Okay, so now the Higgs is heavy. Let's say it's 100 TeV. This is big N. But you have this phi that contributes. And if phi gets a vacuum expectation value, then it's a combination of this that gives you an effective Higgs mass that we see at low energies. Now, this parameter G is an explicit breaking of the shift symmetry. Of the axion. Okay, so just like good EFT theorists, we have to write down all the allowed terms, which includes the explicit breaking terms, like this, okay? So this is a dimensionful parameter, G. We have to write down all the rest of the terms in the potential. So this gives some kind of slope to phi. This is the potential V phi. And this G parameter is small, okay, so we can neglect the higher order terms. Then this is approximately a linear potential for phi. So G parameter explicitly breaks this. Then we see that this confinement of QCD, if phi is the QCD axion, depends on the Higgs VEV. Okay, so when I wrote lambda QCD to the fourth, cos phi over F, this is really proportional to the pion mass squared, which is proportional to the VEV of the Higgs. Okay, so the VEV of the Higgs only switches on when this is negative. Okay, let's call this mu squared. And V is zero when mu squared is zero, when mu squared is positive, sorry. And then V is non-zero when this effective combination turns zero. So let's say that at some phi critical value, before this, in the early universe during inflation, okay, you can imagine that phi is slow rolling along its potential and is essentially scanning this effective Higgs mass term. On this side, if this effective Higgs mass is positive, then this term is zero. And it's going through all the possible Higgs masses up from the cutoff down to smaller and smaller values. Then it turns negative, and this vacuum expectation value switches on, which switches on this cosine, this term with a cosine potential. And so you get these kind of wiggles from the cosine potential. And the amplitude of these wiggles gets larger as phi keeps going down, and the vacuum expectation value then gets larger and larger and larger. Okay, so this is why the wiggles grow. Until they grow at some point large enough to stop phi from rolling any further. So if I told you that, you know, the Higgs mass is set dynamically by some scalar field phi, but then I just put in the value of this phi by hand to make it small, then it's not really solving anything. You need some reason, some rationale for understanding why it stops when V is much smaller than M. In this case, I use big M for the heavy scale. And the rationale here is that the slope, Gm squared, compared to the slope of the barriers of the potential will grow until the barriers of the potential, its derivative, are approximately equal. And this depends on V, and this grows as a function of V. And so by fixing these appropriate parameters, okay, depending on the scale F, the heavy scale M, and the small parameter G, you can rearrange this relation to understand why V is much smaller than M in a dynamical way. Okay, this is a very rough picture of how this idea, when it was first introduced, you know, was quite nice in the sense that, oh, if the QCD axion not only, well, in this case, it can't solve the strong CP problem if you use a QCD axion. So this is immediately excluded if you try and do this with the QCD axion, because you solve the Higgs mass problem, but then you violate the strong CP problem. So then you could do this with another axion that has nothing to do with QCD. You just say that you have some other axion that is responsible for doing this. The other problems with this model, though, is that it requires a very non-generic cosmology. Okay, you need your Hubble scale to be smaller than the weak scale, which is a very low scale of inflation. You need this parameter to be extremely tiny. Okay, this G has to be a dimensionful parameter that is far smaller than any sort of parameter that we're used to putting in. Even though it's technically natural for it to be small, it's still something like 10 to the minus 15 GeV or something like that. So there's some aspects of this model that are non-generic. Okay, the types of UV completions that they lead to are interesting, but not necessarily something that smells right. But I just wanted to give a sense of how the picture that we're in nowadays is one in which we're considering some slightly crazier alternatives to theories of the past. But at the same time, it's recycling ideas of the past in that this mechanism for dynamically understanding why the Higgs mass is light was first proposed by Abbott in the 1980s for understanding why the cosmological constant is light, is small. Okay, in his mechanism, the periodic wiggles of the cosine appear when Hubble is small enough that when this cosmological constant is relaxed to a small enough value that they are no longer suppressed. And so you explain why dynamically the cosmological constant is small. But you also predict that nothing else in the universe exists because it just ends up in a cold, dead universe. Okay. So the types of theories that we're considering now is trying to make these cosmological solutions a bit more appealing, but there are some difficulties in doing so. It's considering things like positivity bounds and how they might be, you know, signs of a QFD that is a bit different to what we expect. It's trying to consider different ways in which anthropic or cosmology or deformations of QFD can solve the traditional problems that have usually been attacked with supersymmetry, composite Higgs, and so on, or maybe a combination of all of these, which we will only know whether or not they are true if we get more data, more anomalies that can help give us more clues. So if we find an axion, if we have stochastic gravitational wave backgrounds from a composite sector that confines at the TeV scale is something that could show up in a stochastic gravitational wave background, which won't be the one that we will hear about today, but is something that could appear in LISA or in future gravitational wave experiments. And there's all kinds of interplays between astrophysics and cosmology I didn't have time to talk about. You know, if we measure the Higgs self-coupling, for example, we'll know whether or not the electric phase transition was first order or second order. If it was first order, then LISA could be sensitive to the gravitational waves emitted from that, but we'll never know unless we actually, you know, measure both. And if it is first order, then this has implications for the matter antimatter asymmetry problem in that it creates the conditions for generating a matter antimatter asymmetry in the electric phase transition. So all of these different aspects, I think, are very interesting developments that will hopefully lead us to what is the theory beyond the standard model that one of you may write down and win a Nobel Prize for someday. Okay, so thanks for that.
Thank you for the whole series lecture. It's, yeah, I'm going to keep talking soon.